Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Good morning, movie lovers. You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. Private Gabe Haggard is out on a classified mission and won't be joining us today. But filling in are a couple of my best soldiers. First up, we have Sergeant Ted Campbell, a.k.a. Teddy C. Say hi, Ted.
Hello.
When Teddy C's not busy bringing death from above, he spends his time working on movies primarily as a screenwriter, director, and an assistant director. Also joining us today is returning guest, Senior Chief Petty Officer Steve Teamkin. Say hi, Steve.
Hello, Lady P. I love the smell of podcasts in the morning.
Listeners will remember Steve from our podcast on 2001, where he gave that landmark film a solid meh. Listen up to find out if he thinks today's sight and sound entry, Apocalypse Now, holds up any better. Then we're going to talk about our favorite literary adaptations, specifically what kinds of novels or stories make for great movie scripts. Then we'll close the show by talking about an upcoming project of Ted's that I think is very special, and I'm pretty sure you're all going to think so too. What do you think, Ted?
What do I think?
Yeah.
Think of what?
About the Swells.
The Swells?
What?
Soldier, you can either surf or you can record.
Oh.
For our first topic, we're going to talk about the number 14 movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now, released in 1979, directed and produced by Francis Ford Coppola, mines the events and themes of Joseph Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness, and sets them down into the hellish landscape of the Vietnam War. The film is narrated by a young U.S. Army officer, Benjamin Willard, played by Martin Sheen, who's been tasked with finding and killing a murderous rogue Special Forces colonel, Colonel Kurtz, played by Marlon Brando, who's led a small band of renegades into neutral Cambodia territory. The Army hooks Willard up with a Navy patrol boat, and he and the crew of the boat go on an odyssey through the Nung River to find Kurtz. With each leg of their journey, they encounter a new, terrifying facet of the war, the country, and of themselves. But I think we can all agree that nothing they encounter along the way prepares them for the sight of an obese Marlon Brando in war paint. The horror indeed. Steve, we'll start with you. Do you like the movie?
Well, if you remember, as you said, my review of 2001 was a solid meh.
Yeah.
In the words of Ronald Reagan, there you go again, because in this... I feel the same way on this one. It's not one of my favorites. It's the sights and sounds, I think, are beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I think the story leaves a lot to be desired, particularly the second half, but I guess we'll get into that later.
Yeah, absolutely. Ted, how about you?
Love this film.
All right.
Love, love, love this film.
Let's fight.
Okay.
Huge fan, but I'm a huge Coppola fan, and it's interesting to see it from two different perspectives, because I probably saw it when I was 15 or 16 for the first time, and then being able to see it later in life as an adult, and seeing the different layers and have a completely different perspective.
Yeah. So how have your impressions changed?
Well, I think part of it is, and I think why I dug it as a boy, is because it's a fantastic war movie. And, you know, and this Brando is amazing, and it's got, like, as you were saying, like, the sights and sounds and the tone of it, and the, just this, that nightmare kind of thing that he created was just amazing and awesome. And then understanding later that his attempt at an anti-war movie,
mm-hmm.
which, in my opinion, fails, but that's...
And it fails as an anti-war movie.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, because it's too cool.
Okay.
And Coppola falls into what everyone falls into, and I think it's something that's part of the male American things. War movies are cool.
Yeah.
And he made a cool movie.
Okay.
And then, though you see the layers and you see the things that he was attempting to create, but...
Interesting, okay. I really like this movie. I enjoy it a lot. It is very cool. And I think it's damning of the Vietnam War in a way that doesn't feel heavy-handed or finger-wagging. And it feels kind of like it could be any war. It's talking more generally about the horrors of war. And I love the structure of the film. I love how it kind of meanders and we go step by step. It's very episodic.
Mm-hmm.
And each episode, each incident, it really helps to mount the tension. And the finale... And the building tension, it really culminates in a great finale with Brando. So, and also, Steve and I were talking in preparation for this podcast about
literary adaptations, and we were talking about Catch-22 and how we feel like that's a very, very difficult to adapt into a movie. But I feel like that Kilgore segment does as good a job or a better job of encapsulating what Catch-22 is about.
It's what the movie Catch-22 should have been.
Precisely. Exactly. In that small segment, it captured more of that energy and that spirit than the Mike Nichols movie. So while the final product was hailed as a masterpiece, it is also equally notorious for having a very failed production, or a very troubled production. But while you were watching the film, did you get a sense that the film was in less than steady hands, Steve?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Well, since I'm the only one here that doesn't love the movie or think it's a masterpiece, I guess I'll have to dig in here. First of all, a couple of things. What you said about Coppola, you know, I think if this movie had been done by somebody without a name, I think a lot of the things that people hail about the movie would have been attack points. And a lot of people did attack it when it came out, the critics. I mean, I don't recall it being universally loved. I think people tore into it pretty well. I remember I saw it in its premiere engagement at the Ziegfeld in New York. And the opening, when you're sitting there and you start to hear the helicopter coming to you from one side, and then it swoops past the screen and it comes from the other side, and then Jim Morrison, the Doors kick. I don't remember ever having an experience like that in a movie theater in those days. The audio, the speakers were just not set up that way usually. Mm-hmm. That might have been the first or one of the first. That was an amazing experience. I mean, there were things about this movie that were game-changing for me. On the other hand, as a whole, I don't think the story holds up. And I really disagree about the building to the end, a fantastic end. I don't think so. Mm. And I don't know if I'm supposed to go by what I saw in Heart of Darkness last night. But it confirms a lot of the things I felt about the movie, which was that the whole second half, I think, is a mess. And then you see the video in Hearts of Darkness, which is about the making of Apocalypse Now, filmed on site by Coppola's wife, but released years later. Coppola's sitting there going, I don't know how to end this movie. I don't know what I'm doing. And he's going, Hopper doesn't know what he's doing. And Brando shows up and he doesn't know what he's doing. And I don't know how that congealed into a masterpiece of an ending or a big ending. To me, it doesn't. That's exactly how I felt. Coppola didn't know what he was doing. The actors weren't taking it seriously. So that's my problem. My problem is basically the second half of the movie. Every time I see this movie, which is about 10, 15 years apart, I watch the first half and I go, why did I like this movie? I love this movie.
Yeah.
But after the spear attack and the chief dies, the rest of the movie to me just is a mess.
Okay. Interesting. Ted, what do you think?
I think it's, you know, having first time seeing the film and not having known about, you know, as a kid and seeing the movie, not knowing. And I think that learning later how the insanity of the making of, it was life imitating art. It was just, and that's the way Coppola was working back in those days, I would imagine. It's just like, he's more the artist than the filmmaker. He was being just as insane as the thing he was creating.
Right.
And I thought it totally works.
Right.
I mean,
I totally see why one could not respond positively to the ending. It doesn't fit into a tidy narrative, that's for sure. And it's very cerebral. But I feel like that works because the movie is about madness. And so mm-hmm. the fact that it isn't super coherent doesn't bother me at all. I feel like that reflects well, that's a reflection of the mental state of the characters. And there's a lot of, I feel like all the symbolism really works and really fits all the themes. And it's also just a great depiction of madness and what it takes and what the Willard character has to become in order to carry out this mission. But I totally see your point, Steve. I could see why it wouldn't appeal to you.
Yeah, I take it less as a depiction of what happened in the Vietnam War and more as a depiction of a film made by people influenced by drugs about the Vietnam War.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
probably Platoon is a much, clearer, you know, indication of what fighting in that war was like. So, you know, when you say this movie shows you about the madness of fighting in Vietnam and the drug, I really take that with a grain of salt. Mm. It's more about the filmmakers.
Probably, you're right.
View. Yeah,
yeah,
it's
you're
a prism,
right.
So...
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that the Vietnam War, the fighting in the Vietnam War, the actual war, is secondary. It's not really the focus of the film. Mm. It's more about...
Right. And I agree with what you say. The setting's the Vietnam War, but it's not about the Vietnam War.
Right, yeah. The scene that I love in the ending, I love when he jumps in the river, Martin Sheen jumps in the river, and he's coming out of the river. You've seen it on the posters. He's got half his face is submerged, and it's like he's... The whole film, it just feels like this regression where he loses more and more of his humanity, and all the things that tie him to Western civilization slowly disappear. And he emerges from the muck, the ooze, the primordial ooze of this river, and he goes and he hacks Marlon Brando to death. It's such a powerful, powerful scene. So I think it works symbolically, if not as a literal interpretation of war or what actually happened. Of any actual events that happened. But I think that some of the tactics that Conrad used in Heart of Darkness, the fear of primitive culture, so-called primitive culture, do you think Coppola employs that in the movie, and is that problematic for you at all? Like that final scene where all the natives are gathered and Kurtz has his army, and it's that horrible scene where they're hacking at the water buffalo. I feel like this is my personal reaction. I feel like he's using our fear of other cultures, of non-Western cultures, and using, like, playing that against us, much in the way that Heart of Darkness did. And I feel like that's, I don't know if I especially like that message, personally.
Yeah, I didn't think that's what that scene was about. That was, I can't remember now in the film if that's before or after the inoculated arm speech.
It is after.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, I think Ed references that more than anything.
But did you find that scene troubling at all?
Well, yeah. They actually killed that animal.
Does that really happen? Yeah. Animals were harmed in the making
of the film? Yeah, that's a real, you're watching a real death.
But is that troubling to you as a 21st century, from like a Margaret Mead perspective? Steve doesn't like it when I bust out other names that have nothing to do with the podcast. Like a cultural anthropology perspective, it seems sort of backwards to have us fear other non-Western cultures.
But yeah. I don't think that's what the message was or what he was doing. It was like what Kurtz was talking about earlier, is the way to win this war is to dig in, go primitive. I mean, it that's what war is. You can't. And that's, I think, maybe that's the analogy or the critique of the Vietnam War is like you can't half-ass it. Mm-hmm. Like if you're in, you're in.
Yeah.
And that's when Kurtz makes that speech. If I had a group that would willing to do that, mm-hmm. I'd have this war over in a week. Mm. And it's not this political chess game if you're going in.
Yeah. So in that sense, it wasn't a critique of Kurtz in that he was correct.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you don't think he was a madman?
He went, well, because he walks away, because he leaves society.
Yeah.
But he's absolutely correct, and that's the only way to win. And that's what Willard realizes at that moment.
I mean, right. Well, let's talk about that. So what, along the way, Willard is constantly referencing letters and tape recordings of Kurtz. What is the relationship between Willard and Kurtz?
Well, Willard is... more he learns about him, the more he's admiring him. When he finally meets him and he realizes that he believes him, but of course at the same time, like this, I think he makes a decision of like, but I'm not going to follow. I'm headed down this path, but I'm not going to ultimately do it. I'm out of here.
Coppola, I think Coppola teases that Willard, is he becoming Kurtz? The more he learns about him and the farther he goes mm-hmm. down the river. I think that you're supposed to wonder, yeah, at the
absolutely.
End, is he going to be converted into a follower of Kurtz or replace Kurtz? That's the suspense, I think, of that whole long section. And that's why he spends so much time.
Well, I always felt that was what the end is about, is Kurtz is grooming Willard to take his place. And he's like, because part of like the madness is Kurtz has no other way out, and basically he doesn't fight him back, him off. So it's like you're replacing me.
Yeah.
So and the only way to replace me is you have to assassinate me.
Right.
It's the only way they're all going to follow you, and that's what they all do when he comes out. After killing him, they all drop their weapons. They say, all right, you're the guy now.
Right.
And he goes, no. He gets on the boat and he's like, I'm out of here.
Yeah. So what do you think Kurt saw in Willard?
Probably somebody that was following in his footsteps. He saw a lot of himself when he was earlier in his career before.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you think he senses Willard's madness?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. They're simpatico.
Yeah, it's a mentor, student, father-son relationship. I mean, you're going to replace me. But it's also, I think at one point he sees, you know, Kurt sees a way out. And his only way out is no one, you know, the army has yet to get someone. Every time they send someone, I think that was the challenge. He probably did that to all the other, remember he sees all the other guys that they sent and they've joined him.
Right.
And I think that's that long in the room with him is that challenge. And he won those other guys over, the earlier assassins.
So do you think he was hoping for someone he couldn't win over?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
He wanted out of his madness, and he didn't know any other way.
Yeah, it's interesting. But so I wanted to talk about the performances. Obviously, there are many standout performances in the film. Ted, what was your favorite performance?
Duvall's speech.
Duvall.
Amazing. Yeah. Brando's amazing.
Yeah. Steve, how about you?
I don't think Harrison Ford was the best. That's why I thought a future superstar. The second I saw him, I picked him.
You just knew.
Yeah. No, I go with Duvall. Kilgore, hands down. Tremendous, yeah.
Yeah. What did you guys think of Brando?
Love it.
Love it.
Insane. He was perfect.
Yeah. I found out in the Hearts of Darkness documentary that a huge part of the reason why he's shrouded in darkness for that first segment is because they wanted to hide the fact that he had gained so much weight, or he didn't lose the weight.
He promised he would.
Right, exactly. And it works so perfectly because you see a bald head and you see a nose and you see lips, and Steve is shaking his head. No, why? What's going on, Steve?
I think Brando's performance was so lazy, indulgent, he didn't even bother to memorize his lines. He was off-speaking gibberish. Coppola didn't know what to do with the footage he shot. And I don't know how you can say that that's a great performance, except that I think you're projecting something on, the great Marlon Brando. It's fantastic, but I really don't see it.
Yeah. I remember when I saw it at 16 years old, I really didn't know who Marlon Brando was, and I was just mesmerized by what I was seeing. I didn't understand who it was.
Well, it was mesmerizing in a way, but it's mesmerizing the way a car crash is mesmerizing to me.
Yeah.
No, not to me. I was totally in it. Now, there's contradictory story to whether or not Brando comes in unprepared. If you've ever read Jerry Zeismer's biography, the first AD.
Right. And the person who in the film says terminate with extreme
prejudice. Yeah, that's Jerry Zeismer, famous, famous first AD. In his biography, he talks about Apocalypse Now. When Brando showed up on set, he hadn't lost the weight. It became apparent that he had never read Heart of Darkness, had no idea what they were talking about, whatever. They spent about, according to what he wrote, they spent 3 days, Coppola and Brando, in Brando's room, wherever, I don't know if they have trailers or whatever, but he talked about Brando's room, talking. And he would come at lunch and go, Francis, I'm gonna break the crew. Okay, yeah, go ahead. And they did that for 3 days. They sat around while they talked and talked and talked. And at one point, that they asked, and Jerry was the guy that went, had to get something out of Brando's room. So the story goes that he went into Brando's room to get something, and he walked in, and there were books and books on the history of Vietnam, on the thing with notes and bookmarks and just stuff everywhere.
Yeah.
Just that all this research had been done.
He got a crash course.
He may have done research, but apparently, according to Coppola's own words, he wasn't saying what he was supposed to say and what Coppola needed out of him to get a coherent performance. So,
but I think that is one of the mystique that Brando created for himself of someone like, he just throws it off and doesn't care. And he was not that, really. It was a thing he created to make this persona that he created for everyone else.
Yeah.
He was a much more trained actor than he let on.
Early in his career, he was. I think later on, at that point, he was doing Superman taking anything, anybody that would pay him $1 million a week, which was outrageous at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Coppola basically helped him resurrect his career with The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
And then Coppola says, I'll pay you $1 million a week for 3 weeks. They're running behind schedule, needs to work on the script a little more. Brando says he might not show up, and he's going to keep the $1 million.
Right.
I mean, that doesn't sound to me like a guy who's really dedicated at that point still to that craft of acting. And it sounds more like he's more interested in the money and not doing the work, not losing the weight, as he promised.
Right.
So I just don't. To me, Brando is a car wreck that Coppola edited into a movie that is interesting to me. Apparently, to you more than to me at that point in the film. But I think the myth at this point is that Brando was giving a great dedicated performance. I just don't think that's how he was operating at that point.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you also one other notable performance, Dennis Hopper. What did you think of?
I love Dennis Hopper.
Love Dennis Hopper.
Give me.
Yeah, Steve, I can
fantastic.
See. If I were going to critique any element of the movie, or at least if I were to understand any critique of the movie, it would be that Dennis Hopper character didn't work for you.
Absolutely didn't work. And, and again, what I said about Brando, I'll say about Hopper, I think he showed up unprepared. He wasn't taking it seriously.
But it's such an interesting choice to make him this whacked out hippie. it seems so out of place in this war movie. But the movie's about madness, and he's clearly lost it, but in this very different way.
He just looks to me like he dropped in from the set of, Easy Rider or something else, and then not... A real character in that setting.
So but I thought, Martin Sheen had a heart attack during the production of this film. And as far as I'm concerned, there's no evidence of it in the performance. Mm-hmm. But so it's hard to believe when people say Martin Sheen had a heart attack. It's like, what? Are you kidding? But if someone had told me Dennis Hopper had a heart attack during the production, that I would have believed.
Right.
So the two characters that make it out alive are Willard and Lance. Why do we think Lance gets out alive?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I never thought about that before.
I think that perhaps Lance represents optimism or incorruptibility. He's like the most innocent character. Mm-hmm. And maybe he gets out because that's hopefully the future.
Right.
And so.
Exactly, yeah. He's the only one... Yeah, I had a similar reaction. I thought he sort of represented American idealism.
Yeah.
And he's like Kilgore. He's going to emerge from the war without a scrap on him.
Hopefully.
Yeah. But even throughout the whole movie, they encounter just a series of horrors, and he seems just blissfully unaware. He's dropping acid. He's water skiing.
Right.
And ultimately at the end, he gets to go about his merry way. Right. It's a critique. It's hopeful, but it's also, it feels kind of like a critique, like maybe he represents some faction of the American public who doesn't want to be involved, perhaps.
Or his innocence and his naivete is history's going to repeat itself. He didn't learn anything.
Hmm. Yeah, interesting.
But I was thinking about that, though, the opposite of, what would the tone feel like if it was just Willard that got out of there? And that was that, and like what you were just saying, that'd be really dark.
Yeah.
There's a little hint of optimism there.
Yeah, but I have to say that when you walk out of that movie or stop watching it, you're not thinking about Lance. You're thinking about Willard.
Exactly.
So I'm not even sure how many, how conscious people were that Lance got out alive. I think that's it's an afterthought.
I never thought about that before.
It's an afterthought, but it's there. And I think it's not an accident that he walks out alive, that he's the one that makes it out alive. So, finally, last question. Do you think it deserves to be considered the 14th greatest movie of all time? Steve, I think I
don't
can
know. Based
guess
on
your
my
answer.
Comments,
yeah.
What do you think?
I think I can guess.
Yes.
That would be a solid no.
Yes.
Would you put it anywhere in the top 100?
Probably not.
Probably not. Okay.
Wow.
I mean, I think there's some amazing visuals and the audio, the opening alone. So I do admire. Let me be clear. I really admire the craftsmanship in a lot of the movie. I just think overall, cohesively, to me, it doesn't come together. It's such an insane endeavor. And the fact that he came out with a movie at the end, you have to admire that. I mean, George Lucas in Heart of Darkness is talking about how insane this whole thing is. And it's true. How many filmmakers would have even attempted it?
Right.
You know, but he did, and he pulled it together. So as a movie-making exercise, yeah, it's one of the great endeavors of all time, cinematic endeavors.
Right.
So, yes, I would say that, one of the top 100 and whatever. But as a movie-making experience, I've seen it a couple times. It's not one of those movies I could watch over and over again. Yeah. So it's two different things.
Ted, how about you? Number 14.
I don't believe in lists. So.
For the purpose of this podcast.
No, I mean, I can't. You can't put anything in a list against what, you know? Like
against Breathless, against...
Right.
Against Citizen Kane, against right. Vertigo.
Completely different movies. Right. There's no comparison.
But is it even...
Against what? Against the Hannah Montana movie. Yeah, it's better.
Yeah. You
know? But it's actual piece. It's an actual work of art. Yeah, and the Hannah Montana movie was strictly a commercial endeavor to make money. You know, so if you can... You compare them to something like that, yeah. But as like something's better than something else...
Well, and it's true that these things are not quantifiable. But for the sake of... For the purpose of this podcast... Where we do seek to evaluate work on this podcast, we are trying to be critical. So while it is sort of ridiculous to try to rank movies, and it is mostly a matter of personal preference, I do think that we can maybe pit Apocalypse Now versus, say, The Deer Hunter, which for me, despite all the things that I've said about Apocalypse Now, and I definitely think it's a great movie, and it's a minor miracle that a movie came out of that production at all, let alone a really great one. For me, I actually think The Deer Hunter is a better movie. I think it speaks to the horrors of Vietnam more than Apocalypse Now and touches on a lot of similar themes. So in that sense, I think that 14 is too high. I think while it is great, I'm not sure that it deserves the number 14 spot. That's my opinion. But as I've said, great movie. Everybody should, you know, if you haven't seen it, you should maybe go check it out.
It's a classic.
It's a classic.
For our next topic, we're going to talk about our favorite movie adaptations of literary works. As I mentioned in the previous segment, Apocalypse Now was an adaptation of a novella that people said could never be adapted for the big screen. There had been several attempts, including one aborted effort from Orson Welles. But eventually it was Coppola who cracked the code on Heart of Darkness. And this got me to thinking about what makes for a successful literary adaptation. Are there certain kinds of stories that work better on the big screen? And how faithful does the screenwriter need to be to the original text when adapting a work? Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, both of you guys are screenwriters. So I was hoping you guys can kind of illuminate what are some of the challenges that go into creating a movie adaptation.
Well, I think it's, you know, you're comparing apples to oranges. It's like someone's done an adaptation of a sculpture in a watercolor and go, oh, the sculpture was better.
Mm-hmm.
It's two different art forms. So in that way, it's, I think the best adaptations it's not jumping off point, or it's an influenced by and using some elements of whatever, and then the film becomes itself, becomes what it's supposed to be. On the business end, an exact, or as faithful as you can be to the original, is when it's something that's super popular. From a business standpoint, the better way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the popularity of the Catching Fire. What are those things? What
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, the Hunger Games.
Hunger Games.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they're feeding the fans, they're being little to the fans, or the maybe the Twilight movies as well, to a certain degree.
Harry Potter movies, good example of that.
See, I've never read the Harry Potter books.
Steve and I were talking about the Harry Potter books, and I'd wondered
I'd read the Harry Potter books and I'd watched the movies, and I'd wondered if anyone who watching the films who had never read the books, if they could understand what made the book special or even what was going on, if they could follow all these characters.
Well, as one who had never read the Harry Potter books but had seen all the movies except the last two, I still to this day don't understand what was going on. It seemed like every movie was the same thing. They wound up fighting Voldemort in every book. It's not like they defeated him, and in the next book he was back and more threatening than ever.
Right.
And it was over and over and over again. Now, I realize they were getting older and evolving, but that's pretty much how it came across to this viewer who has not read the books.
Yeah, you've confirmed what I've long suspected. And also, it seems to me, in trying to be as faithful as possible to the books, they've removed all that made those books special. It's just...
What was special? What was so special in the books?
I mean, there was a lot of character development in the books.
What's a book?
Yeah. But there can be character development in a movie.
But not like you can do in a book.
Well, I think what distinguishes a book from a movie, what people like about reading a book are the details.
It's very interesting you say that, because right now on television you have Game of Thrones.
Right.
Now, HBO has done 4 seasons, 10 hours per year. So it's 40 hours. I think they're through the first 3 books. Yet you speak to somebody who's read the books, and they'll tell you what they really love about the books are all the details and the background and things that Game of Thrones leaves out. And that's in 40 hours worth, that they've still left all that out. In a movie, you've got, 2-3 hours?
Exactly. Yeah. It's about distilling the essence of the book, the essence of the themes, and not being, basically trying to ignore, being willing to toss out the things that don't work. I think that's not to be slavishly devoted to the text, I think, is what makes for a successful literary adaptation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys agree.
You can't be. Looking at some of the greatest adaptations, I'll tell you, my favorite one is Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a novella. And I read it after I saw the movie, and I was amazed actually how faithful it was to the material. And in fact, Frank Darabont lifted a lot of the dialogue and just put it right in the script. I remember when I saw it, I said, this is fantastic. I thought Darabont wrote all the dialogue. I mean, it was King's, a lot of it was King's dialogue. And Darabont kind of condensed the characters and a few things. But it was as close as I've ever come to seeing something I read on screen, almost exact, but come out in such a beautiful way, in such a great movie and cinematic, and it just all worked. Mm-hmm. To me, that was an example of the best.
And I think that leads toward a shorter form is a better, an easier adaptation, short story or novella. More than anything, novel, prose, you have the interior monologue. You can't do that in a film.
Right.
Even with voiceover, you can't. It doesn't even work.
Exactly. So one of my favorite book of all time, one of my favorite books, is Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage. And in 1934, they made a movie adaptation starring Bette Davis, who is my favorite actress of all time. So if ever there was a movie made for me, this is it. But you watch it, and it doesn't have anything that made the book so special, because the book is just a series of events that only have emotional resonance to the main character. It's a lot of interior monologue, as you say. So, yeah, it just doesn't quite work for me. But to me, what I think really distinguishes, what can really put a movie adaptation over the top, is a standout performance. You have to have a reason to watch a film versus just reading a book. If the book is always going to be better, as people claim, then why watch the movie? So, but to me, the reason is because a great performance can really bring a movie to life. And I think for me, one of the main examples of this is To Kill a Mockingbird, just because that Gregory Peck performance is so great. And I think the filmmakers cut all the right things from the book. They chose to focus on all the events that happened with Atticus and the father and the trial, as opposed to some of the more tangential things that happened to the kids. And I think that was really smart. And that, I think, is why To Kill a Mockingbird is often considered to be among the best movie adaptations of all time. Some have even said that it's equal to the book. It's as great as the book. So what are some, Ted, do you have a specific example of a film adaptation that you really like?
That I really like? Well, Shawshank is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's just mm-hmm. a beautiful film. And I was a huge Stephen King fan as a kid, so I'd read Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank. I forget what that is. Is it Night Shift that's from? It's one of the collection of short stories. I forget which one it's from. So I knew the story, and I felt that it went beyond the short story because of those performances. Jackie Brown's great. So different from the book. Mm-hmm. It's a great film. I think it proved that Tarantino was a director. It was questionable up to that point. I mean, whether he was just a phenomenal writer who got just the right people to play those parts and kind of let it go, But then, Jackie Brown, of course, he's proved beyond that. But I remember being a big fan of Interview with the Vampire.
Okay.
And saw the film and loved the film and thought it was faithfully, oh my God, this is just like the book. It's great. But I went with a girlfriend at the time who hadn't read the book. She's like, who's what? What's going on? And realized that they catered, I think, to the audience that loved the book and left a lot of stuff that did not get explained. So someone who hadn't read the book was like, who's what? Who's this?
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that is part of the challenge of adapting a story is to not make assumptions about what's going on. And again, that's Hunger Games, Harry Potter, all these.
Though I think Harry Potter did it better because, I didn't read Harry Potter novels and I understood what was going on in the movies. Okay. I didn't love all of them. I liked the Cuarón one.
But right, that's a good one, yeah.
That's the good one.
Yeah.
I have one other one I'd like to mention.
Okay.
It's one of my favorite movies from the 80s, and I read the book, and it's The Right Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because I love the movie. But also, if you've read Adventures in the Screen Trade, William Goldman, he spends a lot of time talking about adapting that book for a film. And, of course, Goldman was one of the great screenwriters, most heralded Princess Bride, Butch Cassidy, Princess Bride, another interesting adaptation.
Yes.
But and The Right Stuff, he talks about how he was going to do it. He was hired to do it. He couldn't figure out how to get the whole book into a movie, and he decided he would leave out the first half of the book, which was about Jaeger breaking the sound barrier and just concentrating the astronauts. So he did it, and he got fired. And then Philip Kaufman came along, and he did figure out a way to get the Jaeger, who played by Sam Shepard, breaking the sound barrier, plus the astronaut story into one three-hour movie. Mm-hmm. And it was nominated for Best Picture. It won a lot of awards, and it's just a great film. So I think that's a really interesting adaptation of a book and the different ways it could have gone.
One of my favorites, yeah.
One last thing, Clueless. We have to go every episode and mention Clueless at least once. It was directed by Amy Heckerling, 1995. And it's an adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma. And I think when you get in a lot of Jane Austen adaptations, you get this very standard period piece that takes pains to recreate the universe that Jane Austen was writing in. And I think in a lot of ways, by doing that, they miss the point of Jane Austen's work, which is she was critiquing her society. She was not relishing in the costume and the music and the dancing and all that stuff. And I think by taking that plot and setting it in high school, I think that's a better interpretation of the events of that story and a more interesting interpretation of the events of that story than a more literal interpretation of that book.
It would be like taking Hearts of Darkness and dropping it in Vietnam.
Yeah, who would do such a thing? We at FlixWise like to support our local filmmakers, especially if they're friends of ours. So for our final segment, Ted's going to tell us a little bit about a project he's currently working on called...
Myrna.
Myrna. Ted, take it away.
So Myrna is a TV series. We're about to shoot the pilot on our own independently and then hopefully bring that out into the world and get someone to love it as much as we do and give us boatloads of money to go actually make a series.
Perfect. Tell us a little bit about what it's about.
Myrna is about an actress who has had a career of some success. She was successful on the stage, award-winning stage actor, had some success as a television actor, just basically a working actor. Now is into her 50s, and it's harder and harder to get work. There's also the fact that she is transgender, meaning that when she was making all of this great work, and her reel is fantastic, who you see in the reel is Michael. It's loosely based on a very close friend of mine. She's an actor who, again, was a working actor, doing well, and then came to the realization that she had to confront and accept her true gender identity and transition from male to female. And over the years, watching her go through this transition, it's the bravest thing I've ever seen any human being do. And then the stories that she would tell me about just little things. Oh, you know what happened to me today? And she would tell me, the more I heard, it was like, we have to write this down. Not just in her journey and her transition as much as how people react to her and how often it's the opposite of what you expect, the support. And how much more, not just encouraging, but people are a lot better than you realize. And that's really basically what one of the things we're trying to do with the film is, as we say, change the dialogue. So that when we started writing the pilot, it was about our foundation or you know, you find this essence or a theme to base everything else on. And it's about an actress who's trying to get her career back on track. So it's because it's all about the relationships, her friends, the people from outside she meets and how they react to her. I mean, there's so many stories that Marlo, my writing partner.
Let's talk about Marlo. How did you meet Marlo?
I've known Marlo for about 10 years now. We've been friends. She's an actor, writer, director. We've collaborated on multiple projects. I've been her AD. I've been her co-writer. I met Marlo 10 years ago as Mark, and it was years later that I was helping we were creating a short film as a sort of proof of concept for a feature that Marlo and another mutual friend of ours had written, and I was just helping them put the short together. And the feature, the story was about a transgendered woman who gets involved in this political corruption and murder, and in order to sort of hide from the bad guys, she reverts back to living as a man. And it's all about her, do I remember how to do this? And the hard part of actually doing that, because it's something that she is not her and doesn't want to do. So we're sitting at lunch after a tech scout. And this is Mark I'm talking to at the time. So this is 7-something years ago. And she tells me across the table, like, so if there's anything you would like to know about, you know, transgender or transsexualism, like, no, I read the script. I get it. It's a great story. I like it. You know, no, really, is there anything you want to know? And I'm like, what's going on? And then our mutual friend, Jen, who's our co-collaborator here, is just tell him already. I'm like, oh, my God, what is going on? And Mark tells me, I'm transitioning. I don't understand. And it really took me a bit to really understand what they were talking about. And she was saying I don't know, maybe a year in, that she was starting to come out to her friends and saying, I'm transgender. I've always known that I'm a girl, mm-hmm. and I'm finally going to do it, meaning take, you know, it's the hormone therapy and it's, you know, eventually the surgery and all that, and start living as a woman, as who she really is. And then the amazing part is the stories that happen to so many people now, 7 years later, she's fully living as a woman. Don't know. They meet her for the first time. They don't know. And it still surprises her. And that's part of what our story is about, is looking in the mirror and who do you see? Who do you see on the outside and who are you on the inside? So it's this universal story.
Yeah.
And that's really where we're taking it. So we have gone through crowdfunding to raise a very minuscule amount of money, not really what you would want to shoot a pilot, but we did it through FanBACT. Mm-hmm. It's a new crowdfunding platform. So shockingly, we actually raised our money. So now I'm at the point of like, oh my God, we have to actually make this now.
Yeah, we gotta go shoot it.
Which is exciting and thrilling and scary at the same time.
Yeah.
But we've gotten through our first phase of funding, which means we are in pre-production. We will shoot, but we're still trying to raise the last $15,000, which is our post-production. If anyone knows production and filmmaking, post is huge. I mean, we're talking about the sound mix, the color correction, the final delivery of this project. These things can't be done easily without skilled people, and those skilled people don't work for free. that's where we're at right now. So we're, as we call it, our second phase of funding. So we will go ahead and shoot end of August. Marlo's been interviewed on all kinds of websites and blogs, and we're just, the press we've been getting is great. Look for us in the Huffington Post very shortly.
Wow,
we're about to get interviewed for Huffington Post.
Yeah, but it does feel like you've hit upon something that's very popular in the zeitgeist right now. Obviously, Laverne Cox made the cover of Time magazine, so it seems like there's never been a better time for a story like this to come out.
We almost shot this a year ago with a far smaller budget, and then we stopped and retooled the scripts and retooled our story bible, and then things changed outside of us. Like, it's almost like we were supposed to wait another year. Janet Mock on Piers Morgan. We were talking about changing the dialogue, and it is changing.
All right. Well, that sounds awesome. Is there a website where people can go to find out more information?
So you can go to fanbacked.com. You can find us up there. We're all over Facebook. If you just look for Myrna TV show, you Google that, you'll find all kinds of stuff. I mean, especially lots of press. But fanback.com, find us on Facebook, find us on Twitter, Myrna TV show, MYRNA.
Perfect. Thank you, Teddy C.
All right, thank you.
And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, what's your favorite literary adaptation? Make sure to come tell us on our show page, flickswise.com. You can also leave us a comment at facebook.com/flickswise. You can follow us on Twitter, @flickswise. But above all, please subscribe and leave us a comment in iTunes. Let Apple know what a great job we're doing. On the next episode, Emma and Andy are back for another film in our teen movie series. This time it's Michael Lehman's 1989 satire, Heathers. Listen up to see if it makes the Flickswise favorites list. Until then, Steve, thank you so much for agreeing to make another appearance on the show.
Thank you. It was fun.
All right. Teddy C., thank you so much for coming. We'll have to have you on again soon.
Thank you.
Good luck with Myrna, and we'll definitely have to keep tabs on that. So, see you soon. Thanks.
Someday this podcast will end.